is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the America Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today, we'll be learning about grievance number 25, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries, which you just heard, and these, of course, were the notorious Hessians. We will also discuss German-American history, the first German translation of the Declaration of Independence, and the influence of the Declaration on German politics from 1776 to today. With me to explore all of these themes is Dr. Charlotte Lerg. Welcome, Charlotte.
Hi, happy to be here.
Charlotte teaches North American history and transatlantic studies at Ludwig Maximilians Universität in Munich. Her writing includes studies of the history of universities, Americans in Europe, and the Cultural Cold War. She also wrote a textbook in German on the American Revolution called, in German, Die Amerikanische Revolution. In her current work, she focuses on visual knowledge and memory, as well as public history and media history in the 20th and 21st centuries. So, Charlotte, you started there with grievance number 25 about the notorious Hessians. So why don't you just tell us a little bit more about those mercenaries?
Sure. So, in fact, the term mercenaries might be a little bit misleading because it kind of suggests that the soldiers got the money for the soldiering that they did. But it was actually troops that had been conscripted in the German states. Some of them were the Hessen states, Hessen Kassel, for example. But there were also other states involved. But just the name Hessians has stuck. So the German princes, Germany was not a unified nation at that time, of course. And the different principalities tried to raise money by loaning out their soldiers. And so they did in this case, loaning them to the British Army and shipping them over to the United States to fight for the British.
Yeah, and there are two pronunciations of Hessian. We do say either Hessian in Britain or Hessian, but we can use either one today. So there were about 30,000 that came over, and there are a number of interesting things about them. As you mentioned, they're not technically mercenaries. But one thing that I think is interesting about the wording of this grievance, when we look at the other grievances, it's always describing what King George has already done. So they use the present perfect. He has done this, he has done that, he has done this. And I think it's interesting here historically that this grievance is quite different. He says, using the present progressive, he is at this time transporting large armies of mercenaries. So this is like the only grievance where we actually have Thomas Jefferson commenting on a current state of what's happening and the progress of its occurrence. So do you know a little bit about the timeline there? Since the war started about a year earlier and the Declaration of Independence started afterwards, were the Hessians or the Hessians already in the U.S. or had it just been announced that they were about to come over?
Well, they didn't all come over at the same time, but negotiations would have started pretty much around that time as the war started. Although it should be noted that it wasn't the first time that Britain used soldiers from some of the German states. So it was a process that had already been tested before. So even if the negotiations were still ongoing, it was something that was likely to happen.
Okay, interesting. And we know that at the end of the war, about 5,000 Hessians stayed in the colonies. Do you know anything about that history?
Well, I mean, since most of them had been pressed into this military service, it is not surprising, maybe, that this idea of freedom that the revolution was propagating really spoke to them. And there is this idea that a great number of them deserted and stayed because they wanted to lead a better life, want to get away from military impressment. Although it's not entirely clear if it was all for political reasons or if it was simply the fact that there was land to be had and that made them stay.
And not only was there land to be had, but there was a Germanic cultural and linguistic community there as well, which they could easily integrate into. Is there anything else you want to say about the Hessians?
Yes, this language community, so a German-American or a German community, a German immigrant community that had already made its home in the colonies, is relevant also because we could ask ourselves, how did they know about these ideas about freedom that apparently enticed them to stay? And for that, it's important to know that there were indeed German language newspapers, German language printers who made it their task to cater to these troops. And we do have patriotic printers who tried to win them over for the American case. But we also had German language printers who worked for the British, who tried to keep them loyal to the British crown. And both sides worked. I mean, it's a bit of a legend that all the Hessians suddenly deserted. There were some of them who actually quite appreciated the British idea of freedom as well.
That's interesting. It shows us that propaganda in all languages works in various ways in any conflict. Okay, well, we were talking about the Germans staying in the States, or the Hessians staying in the newly formed United States, but let's just take a step back and look at early German-American history. The cradle of German America is Germantown, Pennsylvania, cleverly named, and it was founded in 1683 by an assortment of German and Dutch settlers who were Quakers and Mennonites. They came to America for the promise of religious freedom because they had been persecuted in Europe both by the Dutch Republic and the Swiss Confederacy. I think then they settled in Krefeld, Germany, and eventually they made their way to the United, well, to the colonies, and specifically to Pennsylvania, where they were promised religious freedom, which we discussed in our previous episode on religion. But the Quakers and Mennonites were known for their pacifism, their support for social justice, and also, most importantly, I think, for their opposition to slavery. And after its founding in 1683, just 5 years later, in 1688, Germantown became the birthplace of the anti-slavery movement in the colonies. In 1709, another group of about 2,000 Germans from the Palatinate or the Pfalz emigrated to the colonies, and they were mostly escaping poverty in their home villages. They were enticed to the colonies for the promise of farmland, but it should be said that many had to work as indentured servants, we might say slaves, for many years, 7 to 10 years, in order to pay off their passage, a form of servitude. And just finally, just to note, by 1776, roughly one-third of the colony of Pennsylvania was Germanic. And by 1790, when one of the very first censuses was done, by 1790, 9% of the white population of the United States, the newly formed United States, had German surnames. So Germanic culture was deeply embedded in the colonies, as was Germanic language. So, Charlotte, why don't you just talk us a little bit through that history in more detail, please?
Well, if we look at it through the lens of the Declaration of Independence, it might be interesting to look particularly at German print culture, because it's where we really see this German culture, both visually and linguistically, as a lot of German newspapers were being printed in the colonies, proportionally a lot more than those 9% that the population that spoke German. And what is specific here is that they used the specific German print, the Frakturschrift, which also made it distinct visually.
Right, and the Frakturschrift, just for our audience not in Germany, is the sort of angular, old-fashioned German lettering that you sometimes see.
Yeah, I think what today you would probably maybe call it Gothic. It's not exactly Gothic writing, but it's similar to that. And that's also the print we see the first translation of the Declaration of Independence printed in German in the colonies.
Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So we know that the first German translation was printed by a printing duo, Steiner and Zist, who printed it around the same time when the first English print by John Dunlop was published. So it's very closely following that original print. We can also tell from the original German print that it was done under a pressure of time. So they were trying to really get it out quickly. And they, while they used the Fraktur, they also tried to keep the original layout from the English version, which is quite a printing challenge if you think of the differences of the German and the English language. And then soon after, we see the first printing in a German language newspaper on July 9th. So the first printing in an English language newspaper was on July 6th in the Pennsylvania Evening Post. And then on July 9th, we see on the title page the printing in German in the Pennsylvanischer Staatsbote, so the German language press, which was edited by a German printer, Henry Miller. He sometime during his life anglicized his name. We're not entirely sure when he did that. He had immigrated from Germany through Switzerland and London and had then settled in Pennsylvania. He had tried to get a job with Benjamin Franklin, who had not accepted him. And we know of Franklin's, let's say, ambivalent stance towards the German immigration. But he did offer him the opportunity to run a German language paper, sort of derivative of Franklin's printing emporium, let's put it that way. And that's how he made his way into a quite a prominent printing position in the Pennsylvania Society. And that's probably also why he was tasked, or why he was able to make the first printing in his newspaper.
Can you just go back a second? I'm not sure I am familiar with Franklin's ambivalence about German immigration. So why don't you just gloss that?
Well, there are some historians who have claimed that Franklin was anti-German, which I think is an over-exaggeration. He was frustrated with the fact that he couldn't reach the German community with his papers, for one, because he used, even when he attempted to print a German paper, he didn't use the Frakturschrift, and that's why he was not successful. And we do have a few quotes by him that are dismissive of the German community, but that's about all. And I think it's a little bit of a reach to make him anti-German in that context. But he certainly was frustrated by the fact that he couldn't quite reach that community. So maybe that's why Miller's paper was a way to make that happen.
Maybe just a follow-up question here. This historical interpretation of Franklin's feelings about the German immigrants, it must not have just been he who would be accused of anti-German sentiment. So there must have been, generally speaking, some anti-German sentiment at the time. What was the basis for this?
I'm a little hesitant to make any claims because I have not looked into this in depth. I could venture a guess. There might have been an animosities, first of all, because there was an air of foreignness that was obviously particularly transported by the different language, the different print, maybe some different customs. At that time, most German immigrants were still Protestant, so that what would later in the 19th century become part of anti-German sentiment, which would also be anti-Catholicism, was not so much an issue yet, I would think. But again, I haven't looked into this in depth. But I assume that some of those classical frameworks of animosities were in existence, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting that they, well, those first Quakers and Mennonites were not Catholic. One could see that, of course, there would be some racism against the French and the Spaniards, of course, for their Catholic allegiances, but that doesn't quite apply to those early settlers, although maybe the ones, I don't actually know, the ones who came from the Palatinate, were they mostly Catholic or were they also?
I think they were mostly Hutterites, and so was Heinrich Miller, by the way. So it's also a Protestant denomination.
Interesting. Okay, the other thing you said is that there was this Pennsylvanischer Staatsbote. Was that the only German language newspaper in Pennsylvania at the time, or in Philadelphia? Were there several, do you know?
There were several. I don't have the numbers, but there were a number of papers of which we know. There may have been even more. But they often had sort of smaller circulation, and the Pennsylvanischer Staatsbote we know circulated beyond Pennsylvania to some German communities that lived further afield. So that's why it's probably the most prominent one and also the one we know best. It's the one that then became Patriot, as opposed to another one by the printer brothers Sauer, who sided with the British and who would then move to New York and print for the Hessian soldiers, for example.
Fascinating. In a previous episode, we were discussing the fact that actually sort of literacy and specifically knowledge about politics was rather high, especially in the cities and towns of the colonies. And of course, we always think of this as being English. What do we know about literacy rates in the German-speaking community? Were they also quite high in comparison to other countries in Europe, even at the time?
I'm not sure about German states at home, but in the colonies, they were surprisingly high, or maybe not surprisingly, but relatively high, because the Protestant religions that had migrated placed great importance on reading the Bible by yourself. So schooling would have been a major part of society for children, but also older children and young adults. So teaching to read and to write was something that was very much part of that religion as well. So we do have a high literacy level in these communities, and then we have printers translating English language political theory, English language newspapers. So we really see this translation work in both senses of the meaning, right? Actual literal translation work, but also translating political theory, political ideas for the German language community.
Yeah, and also just the general point, I think it's worth stressing, is that the conjunction of Protestant religion and the importance of reading the Bible oneself means that one also learns about other ideas, these political ideas too, and we have this nexus, a very important nexus of literacy, religion, and politics, all of which can combine to lead to a revolution. That's not only a revolution against, you know, King George's overreach of taxes, but there are the ideas expressed, which you need to be fairly literate and educated to understand some of these more complex ideas represented in the Declaration of Independence. Is there anything you want to talk about now before we move on to how the Declaration made it to Germany? Do you have any other points?
So one last point about the Hessians is that the memory of them is maybe a little checkered. So you, on the one hand, you have this idea of them being sort of drunken dupes, mainly because of their role in the Battle of Trenton, where they'd been surprised on Christmas Day, and apparently a lot of them were drunk, and that's why they lost the battle. But on the other hand, you have this notion of them as being fierce and cruel, particularly in sort of Gothic fiction of the 19th century, Washington Irving's Sleepy Hollow with a headless Hessian. And there is some debate as to why this image emerged, whether they were indeed cruel because they had nothing to lose, or whether there is some of this anti-foreign feeling in there as well. But what is obvious is that they have somehow inspired people's imagination over the years.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The Headless Horseman, the Headless Hessian. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the Hessians and the German-American press in the colonies. Let's just move our story now back to Germany, which was, of course, not Germany at the time. It was a collection of various kingdoms, Prussia, the Holy Roman Empire, principalities, dukedoms, etc. So how did the declaration make it back to Germany?
Yeah, that's quite an interesting story because we don't really know. It somehow appeared. We know of two translations at the time. So in the 1770s, there was one translation in Switzerland, in German-speaking Switzerland, in Basel. And that one is closer to the original. So we think it might have been based on some of the translations we see in the United States in 1776, but we can't be sure. And then there is a German editor who edits a number of American documents relating to the events. And he publishes a translation that is quite obviously translated from a French translation. So it's gone through another translation until it made its way to the German version. And in that, we do find a number of mistakes. For example, the grievances in that one are not addressed to the king, but to the British government, which makes quite the difference. But it might have not been on purpose, but it just shows that this translation process was a very difficult one. And we also see that during that time, during the 1770s, people did not see the declaration as this momentous document that it would become. It would only later gain that position in the German perception of the revolution.
I think it's fascinating what you said, that the grievances were not directed at King George. And I'm wondering if that actually was not deliberate. Because, if it's written for a French society that will about to be going through its own anti-monarchical turmoil with the French Revolution starting a mere 13 years later or so, and the decapitation of lots of kings and royalty, one might see that the insistence that King George is the bad person, not necessarily the legislature or parliament in Britain, might want to get rid of those references to the king.
Yeah, it could very well have been deliberate. It might have been a simple translation error. We don't really know.
Interesting. And how about you talk about the translation of man in the German version, and maybe just to remind our audience, we've discussed several times the fact that the Declaration, of course, says all men are created equal. And there have been historical and disputes coming up to today about what that means. One of our historians argued that clearly Thomas Jefferson meant that it was all men, women, and children, including black people, which we know from the deleted passage about slavery in the first draft of the Declaration. But you note that, interestingly, in the German translation, man is translated more as people. So why don't you talk a little bit about that translation?
Yeah, sure. Much has been made of this fact that in the German translation, man is translated from the get-go as Mensch, as human, and not as man. And some have argued that's more inclusive and therefore more advanced, more progressive. But I think it's more complicated than that, because at the time, Mensch would still have, in the political context, would still have meant men. And by putting Mensch, there's this illusion of inclusion that you don't have by using the term man, which could then more explicitly be protested, as we know it was in the United States in 1848 in the Declaration of Sentiments in Seneca Falls, where they deliberately said men and women and made a point of that, which is a path that wasn't open to reforming this notion of Mensch, because you could easily always argue, well, it is already inclusive, but that didn't change the fact that in the heads of the people, it wasn't. So I'm always a little hesitant to make that point about it being more advanced or more inclusive, at least at the time.
Yeah, and just for fun, why don't you read that preamble in the first German translation auf Deutsch, please?
Wir halten diese Wahrheiten für ausgemacht, dass alle Menschen gleich erschaffen worden, dass sie von ihrem Schöpfer mit gewissen unveräußerlichen Rechten begabt worden, worunter sind Leben, Freiheit und das Streben nach Glückseligkeit.
Hm. Very nice. Thank you. So, translation is a tricky business. I quite like that one, actually. But two things. Obviously, if it was first translated from French, hopefully an original English version was finally found and made its way over, so then there is a more sort of accurate translation later. But you said that really no one in Germanic Europe made a big deal about this. And I, you know, obviously at the time, who knows? But did anyone make a big deal out of it? Was anyone like, you know, hey, there's this big revolution going on, and there are these people, including German speakers, who are throwing off the imperial government and saying we're an independent democratic republic?
I would say it made its way slowly across the Atlantic. I mean, there were some sort of romanticists, like literary romanticists, who made a big deal of liberty and this idea of liberty, but it was very abstract in the early years. And then in the early 19th century, we see interest rising. First, it was difficult to get news from the United States, particularly during the Napoleonic Wars, because of the blockade. There was only one place in Germany that had relatively regular news from the new or young United States, and that was the Kingdom of Hanover, because it was still part of the British crown. So that became sort of a center for understanding and finding materials. That's probably also, although I can't say, where we find new translations of the Declaration, and then also particularly of the Constitution. It's actually the Constitution that seems more interesting to the majority of German observers. But we do see a rise of interest in the American Revolution in the 1820s and 1830s, and then particularly in the 1840s, when the German states were also sort of starting to drift towards their own revolution or their own attempt at creating a nation, where they did see some similarities in the American example, particularly where it came to federalism, but less so when it came to the Declaration of Independence. Although some did pick up on it, more the more politically radical at the time, as the time would have classed them. And it is interesting that we can, again, translations come into play here, because we can see some of the politicization in changing translations. So there's a famous book that is sort of one of the key texts of political thinking of the 1848 revolution, the Staatslexikon. And it has numerous editions. And in the first edition in 1843, the Declaration is mentioned and it's translated into German. And in that edition, the right to alter and abolish your government is translated literally, so das Recht zu verändern und abzuschaffen. And then in the second edition, in 1847, so just 1 year before the German revolutions begin, it's translated into the right to bring down or the right to topple. So there is definitely a more radical slant to it. And that's really the context in which the revolution becomes most important in Germany. It's this idea of the right to revolution, basically, which is something that really resonates with German theorists at the time.
And it's fascinating because, of course, there's an entire wave of German immigrants called the 48ers, revolutionaries who were expelled from the various German colonies, I'm sorry, the various German principalities and kingdoms, and where did they find safe harbor, of course, in the United States. And of course, many of them came to Chicago, actually, Hamburg's sister city. Great. We've been talking about the German Revolution of 1848. Again, can you just remind our audience about the German Revolution of 1848? Basic history.
Very basic. Oh, dear. It's one of the most complex revolutions there is. Or revolutions, probably, because it happens at different times in different parts of the German states. But what is probably most prominent is that we see the formation of a first sort of national assembly in Frankfurt and the Paulskirche, where they attempt to create a German state. They don't really succeed. There are various reasons why this isn't the case. One reason is that they can't agree on the political system. Another reason is that there are various parts of German states that are ambivalent about joining this new union. We have the German-speaking states in the Austrian Empire, which make it difficult. We have Schleswig-Holstein, which is another difficult sore point there. So there are various reasons why this doesn't happen. But we do have this revolutionary moment in 1848 where there is a lot of optimism, but it then gets sort of bogged down into negotiations in the parliament, and then eventually it sort of simpers out, and we see the reaction take over. And really, unification doesn't come until later, but then sort of with might, with Prussian might, which then causes all kinds of other problems.
Right. So, but in the 1848 revolution, you said that in some respects, some were looking at the Declaration of Independence as expressing this right to topple the government, and maybe also a little bit from France as well, from the French Revolution, or no? Would you say those two had equal weight?
It depends on which political camp you look at. So if you look at the more, and I'm using these terms in sort of a contemporary meaning, so the more radical camp would have looked towards France rather than towards the United States, because they wanted a republic, they wanted to really sort of abolish their monarchies. Interestingly, the more moderate looked towards the United States, because they perceived the revolution as a less radical revolution. Even though it had ended into a republican state, they still conceived of it as sort of more of a conservative defensive revolution, as the term they used, the moderates or even the more conservatives, because they thought that there was not a lot of social change. And the, obviously, historiography has discussed this very question ever since, whether the American Revolution was really a revolutionary moment of social change or whether it was just sort of an ideological change. So we do see the moderates looking towards the United States, and that's also why they focus so much on this right to change and topple your government, because they try to find an example of a revolution that wasn't too radical. And they think they found that in the United States.
Well, that's fascinating, because indeed, as we have gone through the previous episodes, what we oftentimes have been talking about is the fact that many of the founders, many of the so-called revolutionaries, would rather not have called themselves revolutionaries. They were wanting to work with Parliament. They wanted to work with the king. They were saying, we're just protecting our natural rights. We don't need to go to war. Just accept how things ought to be here, and we will be loyal to the king and loyal to Parliament. But again, we have this long list of grievances, and eventually they say, well, you know, we can't simply reform anymore. We need to finally declare independence. Okay, so we discussed the German Revolution of 1848 and how the moderates were looking for a model of a revolution that wasn't so revolutionary, and the radicals who looked at France as a more bloody and massive social upheaval. But Charlotte, looking at now post the creation of the German state and going into the World Wars and the Cold War, we have the reunification of Germany, well, the split of Germany, then the reunification. How would you describe the Declaration of Independence impact on German political culture throughout the 20th and now into the 21st century?
In the 20th century, we see a gradual process of growing academic knowledge about the American political system, about American constitutionalism, and sort of along with new theories coming out of the United States, we also see German scholars, particularly in political science, not so much in history yet, looking at the American model of government. And in doing that, they also look at the Declaration of Independence. So it makes its way into this canon in a similar way as it does in the United States. So it's really during the Weimar Republic that we see sort of a first surge of interest, naturally, as we have the first sort of republican system in Germany. And there's maybe a natural interest in America at that time. But
and
we also
Weimar
have
Republic as the government just between World War One and World War Two.
Yes. So the interwar period, the Weimar time, when we do have a republic in Germany, and not a very stable one, but a republic nonetheless. And we see two things happening at the same time. So there's a general rise of interest in the United States because the United States is becoming more of a global power after the First World War. And along with that, there's this growing interest in republicanism, in constitutionalism. And these two things create a rising interest in American political theory or U.S. American political theory, which also includes an interest in the Declaration of Independence. And this is, of course, even more true after the Second World War with the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany, so certainly for West Germany. And then this canon of documents, of ideas, also becomes an important mainstay in the sort of Cold War ideology. So part of the canon of liberal individualism that sort of characterizes the West. And that's, of course, where West Germany desperately wants to be a part of. So this interest in the declaration and everything around that also rises at that in that sort of early years of the Cold War. At the same time, what we see, or maybe not at the same time, but we do see currents of anti-Americanism that also hark back to the declaration in a way that we have already seen previously. So in the 19th century, we know people must have known the words of the Declaration because we do have travel reports of Germans traveling in the United States, seeing slavery, seeing how African Americans are being treated, seeing how indigenous people are being treated, and very explicitly pointing out the paradox of this great preamble that all men are created equal and that what they are seeing is definitely not that. And that really becomes a current in anti-American rhetoric that we also see throughout the 20th century, where the sort of harking back to these famous words of the Declaration and pointing out the obvious or the stark contrast to reality becomes a very dominant narrative as well.
Yeah, two interesting points you made there. I'll start with the first one about how one can instrumentalize the Declaration of Independence for an anti-communist crusade. We've discussed a lot the fact that Jefferson probably said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness just because he needed three, but if he really wanted to add a fourth, which would have been property, the protection of property, which is very deep in the Anglo-American tradition. And of course, the communists do not like private property. So something that, you know, a document in a sort of an American political culture that very much prizes property as a key to life, as a key to liberty, and as a key to pursuit of happiness can certainly be instrumentalized to fight communist ideology. But that second point you made about the very obvious reasons and explanations for anti-Americanism coming from the great, you said, paradox, but you could also say contradiction. All men are created equal. Well, really? You know, that's what does men mean? Men, women, African-Americans, slaves, all that stuff. It's just too obvious. And indeed, the other side in the Cold War, the Soviet bloc, And in fact, East Germany always pointed out the fact that, for example, African Americans would be more free in the Soviet Union or in East Germany than they would in West Germany or the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's important to say that there is a strong current of racism also in East Germany and in the Soviet Union. That is a different kind of racism depending on different contexts. So it's but it of course really helped the narrative to point to that.
Okay, let's end. And before I ask you the final question, a penultimate question on a lighter note. I think I heard this theory, conspiracy theory, we might not, whatever it is, a myth about the fact that the German language was almost the official language of the United States. So why don't you talk us through this legend?
Yeah, it's the so-called Mühlenberg legend, and I'll explain why it's got that name. But maybe first, let's think about why it emerged. So this legend, You've told us just now that there were just 9%. I mean, 9% German speaking is not that much, right? I mean, it's the largest non-English speaking group, but it's still not very much. But certainly in the 19th century, and then again during the First World War, German immigrants or people with German roots in the United States wanted to stake out their own part in the founding myth. And so they mobilized different figures. Another famous figure is Baron von Steuben, of course, who's usually brought into the fray here. But the Mühlenberg legend, sort of this idea of the almost official language, is interesting for two reasons. Firstly, because it underlines how important language was for German-American identity. So that's another reason why we see these German language newspapers continue all the way into the 19th century. They really only subside with the First World War, when you also had some legislation forbidding the German language. So we see this importance of language as part of their identity. And the other reason why it's so interesting is that the United States, until recently, never had an official language. So this idea that somehow German could have made the cut of something that never really existed kind of makes this point quite nicely. When we look at what's behind this legend, we get to a guy called Friedrich August Konrad Mühlenberg, who was part of a quite an influential German-American clan in colonial America and then into the early republic. So Mühlenberg Sr. had been a theologian, a Lutheran, who had immigrated from Germany. And then one of his sons becomes a general in the Continental Army, raising a whole German language battalion. And then one of his other sons, the one Friedrich Mühlenberg, becomes the first German-American to be the Speaker of the House of Representatives. We can trace a petition by some German immigrants asking the House of Representatives to translate laws that have been passed into German for them so that they could have it in German directly and not need someone else to translate it. And this motion is discussed on the floor and eventually is rejected. And it is probably that incident that this legend traces back to. And just to make it even more of a legend, apparently it was Mühlenberg casting the deciding vote against it because he wanted the Germans to integrate better. But we can see all kinds of moments where there is ideology in this legend that I think really classes and marks it out as a legend in many different ways.
Yeah, and the legend becomes more and more hysterical as it grows. Like, and if that had happened, then maybe the U.S. would have joined the German imperial side in World War I, and then the Nazis in World War II, and God knows what would have happened. But anyway, important takeaway, it never happened. So, good. Okay, Charlotte, we learned so much today. Thank you. I ask all my guests as we conclude just to think about what the Declaration of Independence means today. So here you are, a German citizen and an American studies scholar. So what do you think about when you read the Declaration of Independence again 250 years after its composition?
I have to say my first instinct is, unfortunately, to look at the stark contrast, still obvious. But thinking about it with the mind of a historian, which I can't help, I do still think that the Declaration of Independence was a revolutionary document at the time, and we can definitely see it, how it emerged out of a revolutionary moment. And we can also see it historically in how it has served as an inspiration to other revolutions. So I talked about the German Revolution today, but we can also look at independence movements in Latin America. And we can look at reform movements inside the United States that use the sort of revolutionary text as something to build their hope for change on. If we look at the memory of the Declaration of Independence, particularly in the United States, I think it has become so enshrined as a patriotic founding document that its revolutionary potential has almost become neutralized. And looking at it from this transnational perspective and thinking of these moments where it has actually inspired change and inspired revolution might help us to rekindle some of that revolutionary potential.
Dr. Charlotte Lurg, thank you very much. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.